Welcome to the Western Bowhunter Podcast with your host, South Cox of Stalker Stick Bows.
Welcome back to the Western Bowhunter Podcast. This is South Cox, and I'm excited. We have Ed Fanchin on the phone today, all the way from down in Arizona. You digging out from some snow down there, Ed?
Yeah, we had a real wet winter here. I guess we set some records, so it's great. It's great for everything.
Good deal. Yeah, that's encouraging, because if you guys rely a lot on the monsoons for elk antler growth as well, but coming into it with a solid winter also, man, you guys should have some phenomenal elk this year, huh?
Oh, yeah. It's prime, and those that are lucky enough to have drawn a tag already they're very fortunate.
All right. Yeah, I've got 18 points for Nevada for elk, and I've been, you know, kind of banking them, and I put in one time when I could make it work with my schedule. I didn't draw, but I'm really hoping this year that I can cash them in. The unit I'm looking at, according to GoHunt, I should be about 50-50 on draw odds, which is pretty discouraging with 18 years of building points, but it's kind of just the way their draw system works.
Yeah, no kidding. That's a lot of points.
Yeah.
A lot of points, man.
But this year, man, if I can cash them in, they're getting a similar winter there in Nevada. So we should be, you know, solid for good antler growth out there. So, and then get a, you know, a good green up, and maybe it'll be a little quieter trying to sneak around up there at the same time.
Yeah. So you are trying to cash your points in this year?
Yeah. Yep. I've kind of got a window where, the hunt that I'm looking at is, if I remember correctly, it's like the 15th or 16th of August through the end of the month for elk, and which is kind of weird season for elk, but it'll be more of a spot and stalk hunt than really relying on any kind of calling. And then at the same time, Colorado hit the, you know, kind of rotated now. We're all the way at the end of the month. So I think it opens on August 31st for mule deer up here. So that would work out really well for me, assuming I can, you know, tag out relatively early in my hunt there for elk in Nevada and still get a chance to get home and make myself known to my family before I go back out again in the woods for mule deer.
Yeah, good deal. I don't want to tell you this, but last year I drew not a leftover, but a turned in tag. So, and I had already drawn, Nevada elk tag, and I had already drawn a real good mule deer tag here in Arizona. So I had to make a decision, and I turned that tag in.
The elk tag?
Yes, sir.
Wow. Yeah. Somebody else was stoked.
Yeah, well, I got it. You know, I got the last, someone had turned it in, so they don't even call you. They, if you put in for a, what do they call that? I don't even remember what they call it, but I was next on the list.
Mm-hmm.
So they just mailed me the tag.
Oh,
and
no
I was
way.
Like, you gotta be kidding me, with 4 weeks to go before the hunt. And, you know, I had that mule deer tag, so I had to make a decision. And I tried to pull it off, but I'm like, I'll draw it again.
All right. Well, hell, I'd love to hear about that mule deer hunt, but before we dive into that, let's, for the people who aren't acquainted with you, let's kind of start with some background introduction in that manner. Now, you weren't always from Arizona. You lived in California, like myself, for a number of years before you retired, which I don't want to say unfortunately haven't yet, because I really enjoy what I do. I kind of did. I retired from construction and then started building bows. So maybe I can spin that way and make myself feel better. But any case, you were in what, Sacramento area there, or were you further Southern California? I don't recall.
No, I was in Southern California, way down, even south of L.A., almost between L.A. and San Diego.
Okay.
really not conducive for a bow hunter to live down there, but I managed it. I was in law enforcement. I started law enforcement when I was only 20 years old. So I was able to do 30 years without breaking my back, and retired at the age of 50. And I got out of there.
That's pretty darn sweet, because I turn 50 next month, and to think about, you know, retiring with a pension next year, maybe I would have rewound a few things, made some different decisions had I had that kind of foresight.
Yeah, well, believe me, I didn't have that kind of foresight. I loved being, you know, in law enforcement, and they treated me good. So I'm spending my money, California money, in Arizona right now.
There you go. Right on. So were you a sheriff or highway patrol, or what end of law enforcement were you in?
Local police department, city police department, okay. 200,000 people. But, you know, where I was, you know, I don't know, 10 plus million people that lived around there. So all the cities are connected. I was born there and grew up there. And things have changed. And I have twin daughters, and, you know, my wife was on board and said, let's, you know, do it for them. We'll move them to a better place. And
right,
so we looked all over the West, even in your neck of the woods there. And we basically landed in Prescott, Arizona, because it's, we'd still have a lot of family in California, and it's close enough, and it's just really worked out. I'm living the dream right now.
Right on. So what were some of the criteria? Cause I'm kind of curious. I mean, I kind of knew, you know, which state I wanted to be in, and I let my wife make the decision on where we were going to end up within the state of Colorado. But for me, Colorado is the destination. But I'm curious kind of as to what were the criteria that led you to Arizona for other people that might be looking at, you know, say moving from back east where they're restricted to just hunting whitetails and turkeys, and they're thinking about a westward move.
It wasn't our first choice, I'll tell you that. We made a couple of road trips, you know, 2-3 week long road trips to go look. And, you know, we looked at like north of Boise, Love, Idaho, the taxes and the people. And Cody, Wyoming was another one. And just the wind there and the cold kind of discouraged us. We wanted four seasons. You know, yeah. Southern California, you get one season in that summer.
Right.
We were looking for that. And then it came down to our parents were elderly, and, you know, we needed to be able to commute when we had to or when we wanted to. And just the logistics of Arizona was, it worked out. We're not, you know, most people think of Arizona as desert. We're up in the mountains. We're only 5,500 feet, but we're on the fringe of, you know, the junipers and then pines right here. And we have four seasons, and none of them are extreme.
Uh-huh.
So it's a great place to raise kids. That was our number one priority.
Right on. Yeah, it's interesting. Another, and I imagine you probably know Joe Bell, but another friend of mine there picked the same location that you're in there in Arizona to move to. And that was, he moved out there a number of years ago, but when he's still working for Bow and Arrow as the editor there. But he seems to really enjoy Prescott as well.
Yeah. Well, the truth is he's the only one I knew that lived here.
Oh, really?
Mean, huh. I knew nobody.
All right.
I knew nobody. So every time we come out, it was him and his wife would, you know, and he has two daughters as well.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So it worked out great. And it just, everything's been great.
Good deal. Good deal. So you moved out there, what was it, like 2 years ago?
Oh, it's been like 3.5 now.
Oh, wow, man. Time goes by quick. So you've become a resident there and gotten to take advantage of some of the local hunting opportunities. I want you maybe kind of give me a rundown as far as like elk. I know elk, you know, are such demand even for residents in Arizona. Have you been able to get an elk tag as a resident there, or is it you know, still one of those things once every 4, 5, 6 years, or I know it depends on which unit that you're putting in for, obviously, but what's been your strategy there?
Well, I've drawn elk tags as a non-resident when I lived in California, and I live close enough to Arizona that I hunted Arizona every year, you know, in January, for most primarily mule deer. But so I was always putting in for elk. So I was fortunate to draw a couple elk tags, not in great units, but, you know, I was elk hunting and experiencing the Arizona elk hunt, which is unlike anywhere else that I've ever hunted elk. But since I've been a resident, I haven't drawn a tag, an elk tag. And I thought maybe I would have this year, but I'm putting in for a little bit better unit, not the top tier units, but yeah, I don't know. Just a combination of bad luck and not being at the top. You know, if you're not in the first round, then you just got to rely on just luck.
Right.
And I haven't done it.
Right. Yeah, it's funny how that'll work. But fortunately, it seems like deer tags are pretty much over the counter unless you're putting in for one of the premium units. There's still a lot of opportunities for bow hunters down there, huh?
Oh, yeah. It's like I said, it's heaven. I've become fascinated with the Coos whitetail deer and hunting them. And it's a bigger challenge than hunting the mule deer. So I've been, you know, you get a hunt in January, the whole month of January over the counter. And if you don't fill your tag, you could hunt about 4 weeks in August and September, and then another 3 weeks at the end of December. So there's a lot of opportunity to hunt. And on that tag, you could hunt either mule deer or Coos whitetail deer.
Right. Yeah, I remember before I got married, I would fly down there, you know, in the winter. I'd fly into Tucson and rent a car and then, you know, drive out in the hills and just car camp, or, you know, most of it all was car camping for 3 or 4 or 5 days. And then, you know, and then fly back home. And it was a relatively inexpensive hunt. Tags were pretty cheap back then. It was over the counter. And one year I even went down at the end of December, bought a hunting tag or a license and tag. And then, you know, had grand ideas of shooting a buck at the end of December, rolling into the next year with a new tag and license for that year. And then, doubling up. And I think I went 0-for-2 instead of 2-for-2.
Yeah. It's cool. There's a lot of opportunity and there's a lot of deer too. So it's not like it's a, you know, a tough, super tough hunt. You can find deer to hunt.
Yeah. So are you hunting the Coos deer up higher where you're at there? Or I should say further north, not higher, but are you hunting them further north there in those kind of more of those pine forests? Or are you doing more of the desert country, hunting them more of the desert country where it's more spot and stock?
I had never hunted up here where I live before. I always hunted down in the desert down south.
Mm-hmm.
And I would start my hunt trying to hunt Coos whitetail, and then I would end up hunting the easier deer, and some guys are going to cringe at this, but the easier deer, the rut and mule deer.
Mm-hmm.
But since I moved up here, I'd never hunted here, so it's learning the areas. And I live right on the fringe, eastern or western fringe of where the Coos deer live. And I hear they're expanding all the time. But in 30 minutes, I'm in Coos deer country. So, yeah, basically, I go a little bit east to hunt the Coos deer, but mule deer are all around me up here.
So are you hunting the Coos deer spot and stock, or are you doing more eastern tactics in the timber where you're at?
I've tried everything.
Mm-hmm.
And I've filled two of my tags since I've been here, on water.
Okay.
And so the summer months, if the monsoons aren't totally, tenacious and like they were last year, the water is very effective. And spot and stalk is it's thicker country, and I think the deer densities are less up here. I haven't killed one spot and stalk, but that's my goal. I want to kill a bigger buck, like in the high 90s, 100 inch range is my goal this year. So I have been looking at the southern units. I just went on a scouting trip down there, and it's more conducive, more open country to find them and to spot and stalk versus being in this pinyon juniper and pine country up here.
Right. Overall, how are the coos deer doing down south there? I'd heard that the lions were really packing a wallop on them, but I don't know if that was just, you know, one person I had talked to and their impression in that area that they had been hunting there around, you know, south of Tucson, or if that's kind of a larger problem that they're experiencing down there.
Oh, you know, I'm not the guy to ask that question. Lions, there's lions everywhere. Mm-hmm. I've killed two lions in the last 6 months.
Holy smokes.
Down south, I hear about that issue, but the number of coos deer and the number of big coos deer, I mean, we just had a Pope and Young World Record non-typical entered. It's just unbelievable. I remember my fascination started when Chuck Adams killed his world record on the San Carlos.
Yeah,
I didn't even know what coos deer was until then, and I was just intrigued about them. And my guess is, and what I hear is, they're expanding. The numbers are stable and getting better, and the hunting's great. I mean, they kill a lot of big coos deer in Arizona.
Yeah, they're some giants. What did that non-typical, was that a Mexico or was that Arizona?
Oh, no, that was Arizona.
What'd that score?
132, I'm Man. Sorry, I should know that, but, and I measured it.
That's
a monster. It was a mid or high 130s.
Man, oh man. Yeah, that's a tremendous buck. Anything you get, I mean, the coos deer are such beautiful animals, just their cape and how dainty they are. I shot one, it was the early 90s, I think that might have been the last time I hunted them, if I remember correctly. Maybe I hunted them some after that, but it's probably the only 8-point, you know, Eastern count coos buck that won't make Pope and Young. his eye guards were like 7/8 of an inch. So they didn't count. They were just under, I think I missed by, I don't know, maybe an inch or something, but, it was funny. He was a nice little buck, but I want to put weight on the little part of it there. He was a dink, because it doesn't take, what is it, 65 inches for coos deer for Pope and Young?
Yes, 70.
Oh, 70.
Let me give that buck credit, the one we were talking about, the world record. It's 139 2/8.
Okay. Yeah, that's a bomber.
Yeah. And to give credit to your deer, these deer are small, man. Yeah. Even their antlers, like you said, an 8-point. They're cool deer, and they are small. But you know, there is a different level, just like with any animal. There's a different level where these deer get big and they get smart and they're mm-hmm. tough.
Yep. Well, I saw a monster on that trip. One that was definitely over 100, and I missed one. This one make you shed a tear right here. I don't remember if it was the same trip or another trip. It was probably a different trip, but I had glassed one up, and I was down, you know, on the kind of on the valley desert floor, and he was up on this ridge quite a bit above me, bedded down, and so I snuck around and came up on the finger ridge behind him and popped up over the top. And I should have been within bow range, you know, of where he was bedded. But when I popped up over the top, he had gotten up out of his bed and left. And, it was a day, or morning. And I don't remember if it had rained or just was really dewy from the night before, but I was able to track, you know, to get a track from him to see what direction he left in. And he was basically side hilling back around. And I was shooting a compound back then. And so I took up, his track, and I took my boots off and left him, where his bed was, and figured the only way I was going to get on this deer was, just super slow, and maybe I'd get lucky and catch up to him. And I hadn't gone but maybe 100 yards or 200, maybe, I don't remember, 100 or 200 yards, and the side hill dropped into this ditch. And so I slowly eased my way up, and it was, it wasn't like a small ditch. It was, maybe 30 or 40 feet deep and a little ways across. It was kind of more like a little gully really than a ditch. But as I eased my way up, I caught him. He was standing under a tree, and he's only about 25 yards directly right down below me. And, so I lifted up my rangefinder to check the distance to him, checked it. It was like 25 yards, and was lowering my rangefinder. And I only had, my shoulders, my head and shoulders sticking up above the level of the side hill there. So you could only see the very top of me. And he must have picked up some movement or sixth sense, or gave me away or whatever. But in any case, he turns his head and looks up at me. And so I had already knocked an arrow. And so I get my release on the string, and I figure, okay, he's going to spook. And when he does, he's going to go around that, because he was on my side of this tree and there's some low hanging branches. And I figured when he came out from behind that tree, if he stopped, he was going to be about 35 yards, I guessed. And so finally he turns to start to move and leave. And at that point, as soon as he started to turn, I lifted up my bow and drew my bow. When he caught the movement, instead of leaving, he turned and looked back again. And so now I got a shot at 25 yards, but I still have in my head 35 yards from, my secondary position where I need to shoot from, where I assumed he was going to be. And so I just totally brain farted and shot him for 35 instead of 25. And my arrow went right over his back, and this buck was well over 100 inches. It was a really nice, big, Eastern count 8-point, just a beautiful deer. And it ended up, he had a hot doe with him, and that's why he, had hung around and didn't blow out as soon as I popped up. Because usually, if you pop up inside any kind of shooting distance, inside 100 yards on a coos deer, and they see you, they're going to be out of there.
Yeah, anybody that's hunted coos deer probably has a similar story to that. Just amazing deer that you never forget those moments when you encounter them like you.
Yep, that was it was pretty awesome. If you're gonna pick like a 10-day period or a week long period in the month of January when they're rutting to go down there and hunt them, what would you, because it's open the whole month of January, isn't it?
Yes. For now, some units close earlier.
Okay.
Some units are like mid-January.
So if you were to pick a week, which week would you focus on?
For coos deer?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or to just hunt both?
No, for coos deer specifically. Then we'll talk mule deer after that.
Coos deer, everyone starts, they have late December rifle hunts here, and they call that the rut hunt. And it's depends on where you are, but that's the very beginning of them starting to rut. Now there are some really successful coos deer hunters, bow hunters that I pick their brain, and it's about mid-January is when it really gets rolling. And a lot of the out of state guys, they're done and gone by then. So they only experience the very beginning of it. And from what I've seen and what I hear, it's like mid January to the end of the month.
Yeah. That seems like what I recall from when I was down there, that I would usually go close towards the first of the month, or depending on when the ATA show was going on. Cause that's, I kind of worked it around that is a lot of times, then I would end up going either just before or just after. And the times I would go just after, it seemed like it was better than when I went earlier towards the first of the year.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right.
And the mule deer, they rut more in the month of December to early January, isn't that right?
Yeah, and I really believe this, because I've hunted them a lot more, is that it's really dependent on the area and the how far north you go. Because where I am, I could find rutting deer and when the season starts in December, but it's usually end of December, first week in January is the best for around here. Down south, it's probably a little bit later than that.
Interesting that it goes later going further south. And I imagine it's probably because of dropping fawns in conjunction with monsoon timing and all that. But I remember, when I lived in California, you look at more so the shedding of velvet was more of an interest to me than rutting deer, because you just didn't have the opportunity to hunt deer during the rut while you're in California. But the A zone deer, which were further south, from me where I lived, they would be shedding their velvet, second or third week of July, or mid July in there. And then you might only travel 100 or so miles north, and it would be into like the first or second week of August. So it'd bump like almost a full month later that they'd shed. And the season there in A zone opened earlier than the B zones further north there, but you'd run into the same thing with the rut. The rut would be, more of a traditional November rut further north, but during the, that last week of A zone rifle, which if I'm not mistaken is, sometime in early or mid October, maybe it was early October. I just don't recall off the top of my head, but in any case, they would occasionally get some of the beginning of the rut there in that A zone rifle season. So it's kind of funny how that it's, further south, it's going later there in Arizona, or, logically, I think it would be going the other way around. It'd be going earlier.
Yeah, I can't explain it. I just know from experience, and you were just talking about shedding velvet. Something that really blew my mind here is that they have a junior hunt second week in October here, and these deer, mule deer, are in velvet.
Really?
In October. Yeah. So everything's a little bit later down here. I would have never expected that. I'm used to them shedding in September.
Yeah, no kidding. Or even like in August, you're hunting them in Nevada and stuff. And I actually saw a buck shed his velvet the second or third day of the season this year in Colorado. I was pretty surprised to see that. It's only the second time I've seen a deer hard-horned during the first week of archery season. And this, last year was the pendulum had swung to the earliest, it would open. So I can't remember when it was. It was, around the 24th, I think it opened, or 25th, somewhere in there this last year for Colorado. So super early for them to be stripping. But man, it's amazing how wide of a spread that is from, California, which is not that far away. And they're shedding their velvet in mid July all the way to mid October. That's a huge swing.
Yeah.
It just goes to show you having local knowledge of where you're going to be hunting is really important. Cause man, I'll tell you, once they shed their velvet, those deer become a lot harder to hunt.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Especially, in that transition from the time they shed their velvet till the time the rut kicks in, it seems like that's the hardest time. I probably a big reason why I don't rifle hunt is because, man, I love seeing deer. So when they're out there in the velvet, they're a heck of a lot easier to find.
Yeah. Plus all the pressure. I've never in California, there was archery. I only hunted really the archery season or archery only areas. And out here, I'm experiencing the rifle hunt, helping neighbors and friends out that have tags. I just love going out, being retired and everything. I'm out every opportunity I get. But boy, man, they put some pressure on these deer, and thank goodness they're in hiding and nowhere to go to survive, because there wouldn't be much deer left.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah, the Orange Army is it's a large army when you compare it to the bow hunters. Man, it's, you know, you feel like you're getting crowded out there in the field when you're bow hunting. Well, just go out there during the rifle season and experience a whole nother level.
Yeah, that's amazing. But good for them. You know, everyone has opportunities, and being in the outdoors, and there's plenty of deer to hunt here. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
Good deal. So tell me about this mule deer tag that you had. I remember seeing, I don't remember if it was a buck that you'd shot or one that you'd helped a buddy on, but there was one hell of a mule deer on your Facebook, one of your Facebook posts earlier last year there.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about my little baby buck first.
right on.
Compared to the one we just shot in January, I had always heard about the strip. I have buddies that have drawn the strip and killed tremendous mule deer there. And it's like the Jurassic Park of mule deer. I never had put in for points. I'd always bought a license. I just never had the foresight to think about putting in for deer points, because you could hunt over the counter.
Mm-hmm.
Anyways, last year I do taxidermy. It's kind of like a hobby. And, I mounted a couple deer that were shot in the strip, just tremendous deer that I just couldn't believe how big these deer were. So I, for the first time in my life, put in for the strip archery tag, and with 6 points, drew it as a resident, and which was just blew everybody's mind that I had that tag. So this, I'll blow through this real quick. The deer drawing results come out at the beginning of July, and this hunt is middle of August. It starts third week in August, basically, it starts. So about 5 weeks time to prepare for a hunt in some giant country that I had never stepped foot in my life. And I went with an outfitter. So one of the first times I've ever hunted with an outfitter.
Mm-hmm.
And I went out there, and it was a drought year. They're talking 20-30% down, and a lot of guys were turning their tags in, which you're able to do in Arizona one time.
Uh-huh.
You could buy this point guard and turn your tag in. So this outfitter said, you probably should turn your tag in. And I'm like, hey, I got luckier than heck drawing this thing. I'm not turning it back in. I'm going hunting. I don't care. Anyway, long story short, I went out there and shot a really good symmetrical 4-point buck that nets in right around 180. Really good velvet buck. Had a great hunt. Got to help another guy shoot one over 200, and very fortunate. But I'm determined. I'm going to draw that tag again and go back and have someone hold my arrows for me. That's a giant deer, but it's not a giant for that unit.
Uh-huh. Right on. Well, it's, you know, anytime you can get out there and if you're applying with 6 points and you pulled the tag, and then turned it back in, you might be waiting quite a while before you pulled it again.
Yes, sir. No, yeah. That was my thinking from the beginning. So there was no way I was thinking about doing it on my own, but no regrets. I did. I probably, in fact, I know I made the right decision.
Yeah. Right on. Yeah. That's that strip country it's huge. And I've heard that, you know, deer densities aren't real high, but when you see them, you know, you're more than likely going to see a good one, but you can go a long time without seeing them.
Yeah, definitely. In fact, I did go a long time. I went up there looking, and there was days I never saw a deer.
Yeah.
So, and you know, going with an outfitter, that's what you're paying for, is their experience.
Yeah.
And knowledge.
Right. So then you helped out a buddy. I was thinking it was last year, but I guess you're right. It was there in January there that you guys got on that big, that really, man, that's a bomber mule deer.
Yeah, it was a unicorn is what it was. When I moved here, I had never hunted up here, so I had to learn, and I learned on my own, and went hunting with other guys and learned some areas. But so the first few years were I was primarily hunting coos deer, and then this year it was too wet. It was just too wet and too far to go to hunt open country for the coos deer. So I have a buddy that comes up every January. Been hunting with him for a long time, Brent Miller. You met him in Nevada when we had dinner that one day. He comes up every year since I moved here, and I had found some bucks that were, we wanted to up our game and hunt bigger bucks, and I found a really good buck, and we were out there, and I sent him on a stalk, and by the time he got over there, there were just too many deer. It was the rut; they were rutting pretty good. And it was like a 180 type buck, and they blew out. So he ended up just glassing from where he was, and he texts me and he says, "I just found a giant." And I'm like, "Oh, okay." So I go down there, and when I put the glasses on him, I just couldn't believe it. He watched them bed, so we got a long, long time to look at this buck and look at him, and just I was in awe of this deer. I had never really, we had just talked about the rifle pressure. How could this deer survive all those years and grow to be this big? And what reality was is it was a rut. He was a survivor, but the rut brought him out, and we were fortunate to be the only eyes on this deer. And we hunted him for 3 days. Brent had a stalk every day. And on the third day, he was able to put a good arrow into him and killed him. A 34-inch wide, 200-inch net, typical frame with a couple drop lines and an inline. End up being a 213 is what that deer was.
Dang,
Just
man. What a giant. 213.
yeah.
Yeah, you don't see those very often running around over there. I mean, like you said, the strip or like that, but the kaibab. But man, oh man, that's a heck of a deer. I didn't realize it was that big.
Yeah, it's just a whopper. Yeah.
So, your lions, your couple lions that you got, were those both with hounds?
Yeah, they were. Since I've been here the 3.5 years, just glassing for deer, I've seen six different lions.
Holy cow.
And I was blown away because in California, with no lion hunting and everyone saying the lion population is just huge and out of control, I probably maybe only saw six or seven the in entire 30 years that I hunted out there. And here I'm in a place where I see six just glassing for deer. I listened to a podcast, a Jay Scott podcast, with it. He was talking to a houndsman, and this guy was a biologist as well, and he explained it very well. And it's basically the food. There's so many deer out here that the lion population is super healthy, and the abundance of deer, they have plenty of food, so they reproduce and populate in areas where you wouldn't think lions would be, but the food's there. So anyways, back to my lion story. I was hunting deer with my daughters, and I glassed up a lion one day, and then the next day we're in a different area, and I glass up another lion. And this is a good deer hunting spot, so I called the houndsman buddy, and they came out there, and I shot that one, and then just networking, and my daughters play softball, and one of the softball dads is a houndsman, so we've been become friends. And just 2 weeks ago, we had a good snow and went out and killed another one.
Nice. Right on. Yeah, keep those things in check. I've got a friend locally here on the Front Range that's got hounds, and I need to try to hook up with him to do my part in making a dent in the population there. They're such
plus they're cool animals, but they eat good, man. The my wife says that's by far her best wild game eat.
Really? Wow.
The first bite, I shot a lion in Utah about 10 years ago, and I was determined to eat it. And my kids and my wife had no problem, but I was like, man, I don't know about eating a cat. And anyways, it was delicious. And so we devour those things.
Good deal. Yeah, I think it'd be a tough sell for my wife to get her to eat it. And I'm kind of with you on that one. Kind of a little bit of a queasy thought, you know, when you think about eating a lion, and I definitely would, you know, I wouldn't leave the meat on the mountain, but, you know, just that initial thought about eating them is, I'd have to get over it for sure.
Yeah. You know, I'll describe it to you. I call it like mild pork. And I think that's why my wife likes it so much, because it has virtually no smell. Mm-hmm. And it's not gamey at all, and it tastes like a white meat pork. Huh. So I think, you know, and I'm telling you, my wife, she'll complain if she doesn't like the deer has a little gamey taste, she'll let me know. But the lion, she's all for it.
Right on. Well, maybe I can, I fed my wife one time some bear stew and didn't tell her it was bear, because she doesn't even like the idea of eating a bear. But she gave me a sideways glance, you know, when I was cooking, and she's all, what kind of meat is this? And I said, it's, you know, venison out of the freezer. So she still doesn't know she's eating bear. I might have to do the same thing, slip it past her and then let her know down the road.
Yeah, we've all done that to our family or friends.
Right. Yeah, indeed. Too funny. Well, hey, we have a Pope and Young convention coming up in, less than a month in Omaha. And you're a big part of that, eh?
Yes, sir. It's the 10th through the 13th of April in Omaha, Nebraska. I describe it as the best gathering of bow hunters on the planet. It is. You've been, and
yep,
you could attest to that. It's just such a good time, the camaraderie that bow hunters have, and lots of things going on. It's a great facility. It's on the fringe of Omaha, so you're not downtown. It's a conference center with some hotels linked to it, and Cabela's across the street. Just a great event.
Good deal. So when did you get involved with Pope Young, kind of, and when and why, I should ask, and maybe give me a little bit of background on that.
Yeah, I think you did the same thing and became a measurer in California for the state organization. That's what I did. I became a measurer for the California Bowman Hunters, and then they use the same measuring system that Pope and Young and Boone and Crockett do. So I naturally gravitated towards that, and I wasn't I think I would shoot any deer I saw, had a chance at back then when I was young. And so I became a measurer, and that was my catalyst for being involved in the organization, was just meeting people. And I enjoyed measuring, meeting guys that bring me their trophies to be measured, and hearing their stories and making friendships. And it just evolved from there. So I kind of got promoted in California to being involved on their committee and being the records chairman in California. And then an opportunity came up to move on over to Pope and Young, and that's what I am right now, as the records chairman and board member for the Pope and Young Club.
Okay. All right. So how long you been doing that for?
That position for 5 years. Okay. I've been a measure over 25.
Uh-huh. So you were down there in the, cause was it Phoenix that it was, at 4 years ago? I'm trying to remember.
Yes. Yeah. Phoenix.
Okay. Yeah. That was a great escape down there. Beautiful weather that time of year. And really well attended. I had a blast there. I wasn't able to make it to St. Louis, the last one. I was right in the middle of my move coming out from Colorado and remodeling and all that stuff. But I'm excited to get out there, you know, this year. I'm doing 3 seminars there, 2 different topics, mule deer and then kind of a introduction to, you know, traditional archery or transitioning to traditional archery there. So I'm really looking forward to doing that. I had a great time and all the seminars seem like they're really well attended. It was a fun experience.
Yeah. Thanks for doing that. And, you'll see me seated in the audience trying to learn.
Yeah. Right on. Right on. Forgot how much work it is putting a seminar together. I started pulling pictures, a week or 10 days ago and then building, you know, when you're only working in PowerPoint once every couple of years and you have to basically reinvent the wheel every time, you know, doing the layout and I've got some video stuff to, you know, footage that I want to use to support, both seminars and then embedding that when you're not a, you know, computer geek, it's like, feel like you got 2 left thumbs going into it. So it's going to be a 3-week struggle here, putting it together, but I'm up for it. So it's going to be a fun one.
Yeah. You'll get through it.
Yep. Yep. That I will. Well, is there anything else that you, you wanted to add in, you know, about the Pope and Young there, and then we'll transition out of that, maybe back into a little bit of hunting before we wrap this up?
Yeah, for sure. Just, if you're thinking about going, quit thinking about it and just go. I mean, pretty much everybody that I've ever, had come along with me or encourage them to go, their attitude is they'll never miss another one. It's just, you know, it's humbling to sit next to Chuck Adams at a dinner table and him ask you about your hunts and just stuff like that. Everyone's just a bow hunter there and it's a good time. Seminars, banquets, meetings, just all kinds of good stuff. It's great, great 3-4 days to be out there.
Yeah, there's some really accomplished people there and some really accomplished guys that nobody's ever heard of. It is pretty remarkable.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Right on.
And, you know, who doesn't want to talk bow hunting? Jeez.
Yep. Yeah. If anyone's listening to this, they're right in their same shoes as we are. That's for sure.
Yeah.
No doubt about it. Well, what have you got coming up this fall? Are you pretty well sticking to Arizona or are you venturing out of state at all?
Well, I'm 0-2 on the Arizona draw and Wyoming draw. So. Oy. My hunts are kind of dependent on what I draw. And then my fallback has always been Arizona. And so I will hunt deer in Arizona. I'm going to probably go to Kodiak in September since I don't have a September elk tag and do that.
On that one, have you hunted that late, you know, the Kodiak November rut there, or is it, have you always gone early?
I've been 5 times and my first trip was a boat trip in November.
Okay.
And I'd rather sleep on the island with the bears than deal with that winter weather. I like the earlier hunt. I go in September, which is unusual. Most guys are hunting moose or right. elk or something else in September, and that the times I've gone is when I have had a tag. So it's worked out pretty good.
So, are you going first part of September or what part and when are they shedding their velvet up there?
They shed in August.
Oh, okay. So you're hunting them hardhorn then.
Yeah, they're hardhorn. They don't, they have still have beautiful capes. Their winter, their summer fur is already transitioned. It's not as thick as the later hunts, but they're fat. They're fat in September too. They had bulked up in in August to get that fat. I like it. The weather, you can't predict the weather, but I've had great weather.
Yeah, you're certainly going to get more likely to get good weather in September than you are in November.
For sure. Well, and if you go on a November hunt, you could just count on losing half your hunt to weather.
Yeah, and an important thing to think about there, and maybe a lot of people don't, is got a lot longer of a day to hunt in September than you do in November.
Oh, for sure. And they glow on the green hillsides. They just stick out.
Yep. And bears are down there on the rivers, so they're the big ones, the big bears. So you don't have to worry about them so much as you do, there in November, maybe.
Every time I've gone, I've seen bears up close in different habitats. So they are definitely on the rivers, but they're everywhere. You see them on the top of the mountains too. Surprisingly.
I'll be damned. Yeah. I've fished it. I've hunted Kodiak once in that November hunt, and then I fished it three times, middle of June there on that King Salmon run. That was a blast, but I haven't been back up there to hunt them. I hunted, out of Southeast Alaska, Prince of Wales there. I did an early August hunt and had a great time there, had good weather, but the bugs were pretty nasty. How are the bugs up there in September?
Almost non-existent.
Really?
They come when there's no breeze. They're out.
Uh-huh.
But not a problem.
All right. So are you flying and getting dropped at a lake, or logistically, how are you getting there to where you're going?
Yeah. Lake hunt on floats.
Uh-huh. And then what, a week or 10 days?
I personally wouldn't do less than 10 full hunting days there, because you're going to lose days to weather. And then you got three deer tags and maybe a caribou tag, two guys. You're either killing deer or packing meat.
Uh-huh.
And when the weather's good. So 10 days for me is like minimum.
Yeah. So do you have your pilot on call if you need a meat pickup, or how do you deal with that if you shot a deer early in early in the hunt?
Yeah, they do. They come out. I've kind of researched and found a way to keep the meat. It still could be warm enough that meat's going to spoil in September. So what I do is I sink it in the lake that I'm at.
Oh.
And that temperature is pretty consistent and, cold enough that I've never lost an ounce of meat. So I'll sink it in the lake, and then they do fly by, on their regular routes of picking up and dropping off people. And if they're in the area and you kind of have a message system set out, they'll land and pick your meat up without you even being in camp and take it back. And they have a cooler at the float dock there.
All right. That's pretty slick. So what are you usually going with, one or two buddies when you go out?
I only personally, I'm kind of selfish. So I only go with one other guy. I think three's a crowd, and, mm-hmm. and those deer, those deer, you blow them out. I'm sure seen it where you start a tidal wave of deer, like your Nevada hunts. You blow one deer out and they'll clear out the whole basin.
Right.
That's exactly what happens there. Too many deer, and they take all the deer out of the basin. So, if you get two groups of guys hunting two or three different small mountain ranges, you might not get 10 days hunting.
Right. Yeah, no doubt. Have you been monitoring the winter up there, as far as they've been having any problems with winter kill thus far?
Not the south end of Kodiak where I hunt. No,
okay.
It's in fact, yeah, it's a good, there's a, 2 years ago, they had one winter that affected, it was kind of weird, certain parts of the island. I guess that's somewhat common, but the south end, where I hunt did not get affected.
Mm-hmm.
So it's probably been at least 6 years, maybe more, since they've had a significant die-off that there should be some really good bucks out there.
Nice. Yeah, that gives you plenty of chance for you know, getting a good age class there.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the guys that are serious about Kodiak, they pay attention to that. You know, if they're looking for those bigger deer.
Right. Yep. So you're basically doing a do-it-yourself hunt where you're just hiring a pilot to, you know, charter to drop you off, and then you're bringing up all your own gear and all that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. The last time I went 2 years ago, I used a outfit in Kodiak that rented some gear.
Uh-huh.
So we had a deluxe camp. I mean, we slept on cots and had a cook tent. So I bring my own camp, but we rented some luxury items that we normally don't have. It was pretty nice.
Yeah. Yeah. When you get some inclement weather and you can, you know, stand up and walk around inside a tent or have a, you know, separate area just to lounge around, man, that makes a heck of a difference from a comfort standpoint versus being cooped up in a tent where you can only sit up before you hit your head.
Yeah. Comfort. Yeah. And sanity as well.
Mm-hmm.
Being in a tent for 2-3 days straight, that's no fun.
You yeah.
Run out of card games, run out of whiskey.
Indeed. Yep. Have you ever looked at hunting the goats up there on Kodiak?
Yeah, I have. And I'm a blue collar guy, and they price themselves out of my range.
Yeah.
I'm so disappointed. So disappointed that I didn't do it 3-4 years ago, because I'd always looked into it. But yeah, it's crazy. And I apply down here in the States for goat tags as well. And I may never get to hunt goats.
Right. Yeah.
When the long race. Yeah. It's phenomenal. If you're just after a good, really nice, mountain goat, there's no better hunt in my opinion.
Yeah. That's been my bucket list animal for quite a few years. I suppose if I would have prioritized it or did it properly, I could have started banking and putting some money away year by year. But then you still, I mean, even if you save up for it a long time, you're still putting out the same amount of money versus, you know, just coming up with it, ponying up all at once, digging into your bank account. So, I mean, when you're talking about you could buy a, you know, a pretty decent car for the cost of a hunt, it gets hard for me to justify, you know, doing it myself. I mean, everyone's got their own perspective on it, but that's kind of always how I look at it.
Right. Yeah. You know, just like you mentioned, if we'd had the foresight to do that, we'd have had all these bucket list animals.
Yeah.
You know,
I mean, I remember back in the day, you know, when I was younger, a dull sheep hunt was $5,000, and I was thinking the same thought. Wow, I could buy a pretty nice car for $5,000. And now look at where the cost of those things are. My goodness.
Yeah, we got that Nike slogan, just do it. That has a little meaning behind it.
Right.
It does.
Yeah, because in another 10 years, when it's that much more expensive, I'll be thinking the same thought still.
Right.
Yeah. 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 Well, it's fortunate that, you know, both of us really enjoy mule deer hunting, and that's still a pretty, you know, a cost attainable hunt there.
Yeah. Come on out to Arizona. It's cheap and fun.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, yeah. And the nice thing is, you know, for me, for mule deer, everything's pretty much August and September, you know, end of August, early September, and then you're done. And I got to get back into the swing of things and you know, start putting, you know, Arizona back on my calendar again. Been too long.
Yeah. The rut is something, it's unique to hunt in the rut, and especially if you're hunting big bucks too. I got that coos deer bug, but I'm telling you what, that buck that Brent shot and the bucks that I left on the hill this year, that if they could survive, oh my goodness, and this coming January, I hunted over 20 days this January.
Wow.
Because when Brent left, I tried to kill that 180 buck, and I wouldn't take anybody with me, and you know, having a spotter really helps. But anyways, I'm looking forward to January.
Good deal. Good deal. Right on. Well, I think you'll probably give it a wrap. It's been about an hour, so we got a good solid podcast. It's been a long blank spot for me. It's kind of funny. You know, I first started doing this, I was all nervous about, you know, about recording and all that. And you kind of almost got that all over again. I can't remember the last time I recorded one. So it's good to knock the dust and the rust off. And I appreciate you coming on here and giving us an hour of your day there.
Absolutely. No problem. I know I took an hour out of your day. You're probably building bows.
No worries.
It's
good to hear. Oh, you know what? Before I forget, I wanted to ask you about your taxidermy stuff. I actually went to taxidermy school back in the early 90s myself, and I never, I started a business, but it was tied in with a bow shop that I had. And then my partner and I ended up selling the shop or kind of dissolving the partnership. And so that kind of all went away, and I went back into construction. So I never really followed through with it long term. But how did you get into doing taxidermy?
Well, I was worried when I was going to retire, when I was planning, you know, I was looking at like 2 years out and I'm done, and I wanted a hobby that I could, that I enjoyed, but I also wanted to make a little extra money so that I could do not an extravagant hunt, but a hunt that I couldn't afford otherwise.
Yeah.
Taking money away from the family. So that basically I went to, my local taxidermist, Keith Hopkins in Riverside, and hit him up. And the biggest fear of a taxidermist is I'm training somebody and them opening a shop down the street.
Yep.
So I convinced him that I was moving. I wasn't going to take any of his customers, and I think he would have done it regardless. But he really helped me out and mentored me, and he's an artist and does great work. And so I learned from a really good guy, and I have a little bit of artistic background in me as well. So it just meshed, and I got better, and people trusted me with doing their animals, and now it's full blown out of control. I got to learn how to say no. And I quit taking animals this year in November.
Wow.
And 'cause I want to be done by June. July is when I start scouting for coos deer and finding new spots. And I've been using cameras lately. And so I want to be done by July or end of June at the earliest. So anyways, that's my taxidermy story. And
good deal.
It's been fun. I enjoy it. I really do enjoy it.
Yeah. It looks like you're doing some beautiful work. And you know, one thing, you know, we were talking about bucket list animals I think that, you know, for most 99.99% of the population out there, and myself included in this lump there, you know, when you talk about people setting the goal of like the super slam or, you know, the sheep slam and stuff, it's pretty out of reach for the average person. But one of your posts there was talking about the deer slam, which a friend of mine had first brought to my attention, I don't know, 15 or more years ago, that he wanted to do that. But he was trying to do it all in one season, which he never did accomplish. But it was a pretty neat goal. But just getting the deer slam, you know, it's kind of a mini attainable goal. It may not even be mini. It could be a lifelong goal for, you know, for a lot of us. But it gives you some really great adventure hunt opportunities that could be done on a, you know, on a realistic budget. And it was neat to see you had a whole slam, deer slam, that you're mounting there.
Yeah, it was kind of, I didn't even think about it. I was like doing all this work and I'm like, hey, I got all five deer species here in different stages. It was pretty cool.
Yeah. Yeah. It's something that, you know, for the average guy like you and I, be a neat goal to kind of tuck away there. And, another one, a friend of mine and a customer of mine, he's got a really unusual one that I'd never heard of before until he brought it to my attention, that he's hunting, making a goal to hunt all 50 states. And, he's, I don't know, I think he said he was like at number 42 or 43, but hunting, you know, really attainable animals, you know, deer and elk and bear and, things like that. But he's making a goal to hunt all 50 states.
Wow. That's pretty cool. Never thought of that.
Yeah. I could probably check off, maybe 8 or 10 or maybe 12 or something, but I'm a long ways from hitting that mark. I think I've taken all, let's see, I've definitely shot mule deer and blacktail and whitetail, Columbia blacktail and coos deer. So I actually have pulled it off. I just, not all of them make book, which maybe getting a book coos buck is should be my new goal here moving forward.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Come on out.
Good deal. Yeah. Give me something to shoot for, but thanks again, Ed there. I appreciate your time and I hope you got some good plans for the rest of your day. Maybe knock out some more of those mounts and get closer to getting back out there scouting.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks, South. Appreciate it.
Sure thing. All right. Well, I'll see you in Omaha next month.
Yeah, for sure.
Good deal.
If you've enjoyed listening to the Western Bowhunter podcast, please subscribe and take a few seconds to review the podcast and share it with your friends on your social media platforms. This will help us in the podcast rankings and will help us grow. If you have a topic or a person you'd like to hear from in a future episode, please email south@stalkerstickbows.com with podcast in the subject line. You can further support the podcast by picking up a Western Bowhunter Podcast t-shirt or a window sticker from the Stalker store at stalkerstickbows.com. Thanks for your support. Too many years have passed me.